trouble is, I'm married badly. No, that's the truth. My mother, God rest her, was born in Newlands, nurtured on the banks of the Blue Cart, at the uncomprehensive Shullens Academy, and in the Orpheus Choir under Sir Hugh Robertson. She knew that the children in Glasgow, who lived first of its south side, were Aboriginal, and no fit partners for her offspring, whether they hailed from Puzzle Park or even Ridley. I was young and athletic and headstrong in those days, and in the consequence of the words of the song, I married a papist called Bridget McGinn. Could have been worse, she could have been called Bridget McConnell. The only redeeming feature Marjorie possessed was her urbane brother Jack, who had been taught proper Britishness in a naval destroyer commanded by a Viscount, and spent several years of the war dodging U-boats between Cape Town and Sydney. On being demobbed, he completed his degree at Unthanks Premier University, and then promptly emigrated to Oz, where he acquired 5 further degrees, in addition, in due course, to an SI fellowship, and for the next half century became a hard-working Antipodean academic. At the end of work every day, at about 2:30, he accompanied his colleague, an equally industrious Adelaide University professor of music, to the South Pacific beach to lie in the 40-degree kissed sand and read a 600-page thriller which had just been published entitled Lanark. I think because he was a prototype emigre more in love with homesickness than his native land. When in due course we visited him, he complained that a 3-inch thick paperback was impossible to prop up on the sand without obscuring a lot of the text by keeping spilling liters of Foster's all over the pages. But his admiration for the emerging young writer was unbounding. Why, he kept asking, do they all have to depend for proper recognition only first of their own country? I hope Alistair is going to provide us with the answer to that. As the fellowship expands, apart from guaranteeing the SI's existence for 2 or 3 more centuries on the road to independence, we are now accumulating more fellows across the globe. California, Normandy, Bad Godesberg, the Old Savoy, Buenos Aires. You'll notice the pronunciation. James Gray in Frankfurt. Do you think he's a relative? You know, you have a cousin, you know?
Probably.
Right. Austria, Brussels, Dublin, Rotterdam, and quite a few in Australia. Recently, one of them was keen to start a branch of the Celtic League, he said. He hired a hall in Sydney, and the advertisement for an inaugural soiree attracted several hundred Aussies. He was surprised, however, when they all turned up wearing t-shirts with green and white hoops. You can tell the ones that understand that. Even they, however, were following the elections in Scotland with great glee, which of us not? As Fiona has said, and I hadn't written this before, I'd tell you how I recruited her. I persuaded her that she looked like Gandhi. I never apologized to you for that, did I? Did we ever believe we were going to arrive at the day when our own First Minister of Scotland, Sir Alexander Salmon, would insinuate his massive right arm round the trembling waist of the Queen of England, as if he were an Australian Prime Minister? While enjoying a cosy chat with her about the jurisprudential right of a nation to govern itself. Recently, though, my young wife and I had been practicing polling techniques in Chateaubriand in Brittany. We happened to be there on the first French presidential polling day. It was a delightfully warm evening, and the presiding officer was very welcoming. "Bonsoir, monsieur," he said in French. How can I assist you? I explained I had a European Scottish passport, which, especially in the light of the old alliance, might allow me to vote for the president. "For whom would you be voting, monsieur?" I said, "General de Gaulle." "Oh, monsieur, I regret he's dead. But have a good evening." I was also subsequently arrested at the Govan polling station for alleged racially motivated breach of the priest, and that's a story for another occasion. The Oliver Award. "Made," the rubric says, "to the journalist, author, poet, critic, illustrator, radio or television personality who's done most in past years to advance the cause of Scottish self-respect." Some candidates qualify under all of these categories, if you think about it. It's not a condition that the recipient should be a member of the Scottish National Party. Previous ones have included Ewan Bain, he was the first Superman, Tom Weir, Professor Derek Thompson, Jimmy McGregor, Norman McCaig, Dr. John Purser, did you know who he was?
Oh yes.
Colin Bell, Sir Alistair Dunnett, the Gaberlunzie, Dr. Elspeth King, Dr. Paul Scott. Two we're honoured to see here today, I notice, perhaps hoping to be nominated again. Or because the decanters are empty. Ian Anderson, Jimmy Reed, and last year, Dr. Willie Ewing. The only instruction our control freakish chairman gives me every year is, don't lionize them. Every year they all sneak up to me and say, whatever you say, you think at least you could lionize me. Halfway through. We're often asked how they're selected by the panel of judges. We got a letter the other day asking why we didn't choose much younger ones. Well, we have to wait until we've had time to achieve. Of course, the eagle trick is not to wait too long. So they tell me there exists a list of prospective recipients. I was being asked this. Such people as Sir Sean Connery, waiting for a gap in between films so we can fix a mutually convenient date. I have no idea whether the judge's broad-mindedness extends to such eminent people as Lord Fuchs, Lord Watson, Lady Wendy Alexander, and Hampstead Kirsten Warren. At one stage, our much-missed compatriot, the marvellous David Rollo, it's good to see his son here today, nominated Mr. Al McGrahy. But legal complications have now arisen about fixing a date. One regret is that we never got to Robin Jenkins in time. He and I were at school together, and I thought, one way or another, we like to think it's a great institution, as the yearly growing attendance testifies next year's may have to be held in Edinburgh Castle. The 25th candidate has been selected simply because he attended the same uncomprehensive school as Oliver Brown. And he wrote some good wee books and did some good wee murals and drawings and things. You see, I'm not going to lionize him. The who's who of two nations carry formidable entries. Our own native one says he's an artist and writer. The Anglo one has him as a self-employed verbal and pictorial artist. That sounds like Morag's assessment. Early teacher, theatrical scene painter, TV playwright, 17 performances today. What do you do in your spare time? It's four on stage, one-man exhibitions, Glasgow University writer in residence, consulting professor of creative writing, Oran Moore, an unubiquitous chip mural decorator, Strathclyde University and People's Palace Work. A list of novels, short stories, lean tales, soggy tales, most of which I know a number of guests here have enjoyed, broadcast pamphlets on Scottish self-government. The Scottish National Library has a collection of unpublished praise, and so on and so on and so on. Personally, I'm too young to have read only some of his writing, but Lanark, twice, same time rushed up in the last month. It's been acclaimed in lavishly, justifiably lavish terms across the globe for decades now, making comparisons with Sterne, Blake, Dante, Joyce, Lewis Carroll, Scott, Arnold, Bennett, Duddle, Orwell. For me, it's clearly Kafka. Lanark is an unfinished autobiographical thriller like Kafka's America. Alistair's is unfinished because he keeps adding afterthoughts with each reprinting, and there's lots of years for many more amendments and Calvinist repentances. I got into trouble when I quoted some lines of Norman McCabe's when he was here to prove that he was a closet nationalist. He was going to quote them later himself for the same purpose, and he was pretty upset. Alistair is a self-employed closet nationalist. Hundreds of quotations are available to prove that. I've just found one which I think is the best, which I'll now dare to use. Immer streben sich bemüht, den Kirsten wir erlösen. I'm glad you all speak German. The Salta, I'll translate that for people later. The Salta society, that fundamentalist wing of the Liberal Democratic Party, pipped us in acclaiming this quiet genius of our nation some time ago. Scots Independent, the fundamentalist wing of the Scottish National Party, has much pleasure now in adding our own tribute by presenting him, have they even got it here? We have. With the Oliver Award of a decanter and a wherewithal to keep it replenished. We're not going to lionize you, but today we salute you, young man. I don't know.
Yes, he can.
Oh, yes. Thanks. You will have found beside your plates this rolled up poster. It was my wife's idea, Morag McAlpine. She's 15 years younger than me and became a Scottish nationalist at the age of 15.
Well done.
She grew up in Dumbarton, and her parents were impeccable Scottish Labour Party supporters.
Yeah.
And God knows why. It must have been just an instinct that she decided to become a Scottish nationalist. I became keen on a Scottish independent government myself at the age of 17. I was in Whitehill Senior Secondary School, and I had taken history. And one of my best friends, George Swan, had taken geography. Now, how can you know history if you don't know geography, or vice versa? However, we must specialize, they said. And I was very bad at numbers. And I thought that Scotland was a very powerful part of the United Kingdom of Britain. I mean, apart from Walter Scott and all that, I mean, we had Keir Hardie, the founder of the Labour Party, and wasn't the Labour Party the dominant party in Parliament? So, and then my friend pointed out, because he'd taken geography, that the Scots representation in Parliament was 10% of the English representation. And it immediately struck me, if they're as wee as that, they can't control the country. In other words, the English are going to be managing us, and we can't manage ourselves. And this struck me as a straightforward mathematical explanation. It didn't lead me immediately to want to vote SNP, because at that time the welfare state that the Attlee government had set up as a result of the Beveridge report was in full working order, and I believed, and I think rightly, that Britain had become an example to the rest of the world. Unlike the USSR, we had constructed a welfare state without getting a single party dictatorship. And unlike the United States of America, we hadn't given over the government of our country to millionaires. Well, of course, things have changed since then. Under Margaret Thatcher, and since then, the government of Britain by millionaires, the general notion that the whole world should be governed by millionaires. I rave. I didn't mean to. What happened was, Morag, my wife, being an early Scottish nationalist, she went about collecting all the pamphlets she could find about Scottish nationalism, and also all the books she could find that had been printed by Bill MacLennan, who wasn't particularly a Scottish nationalist. He would have been called, I suppose, a Douglas. Douglas economic system.
Social credit.
He was a Douglas social credit party individual, but he probably shared anybody. In Scotland, and he published MacDiarmid's The Kind of Poetry I Want. He did good things. In 1956, Oliver Brown was a teacher of French in Whitehill Senior Secondary School when I was there. I was not in the French class. I was in the Latin class, because in those days you couldn't get into Glasgow University, you couldn't get into Scottish universities, and yes, you knew Latin. And my parents were so keen that I get into university that I took Latin, though I hated the subject, and never learned it, because my teachers didn't regard Latin as something you could enjoy reading. They thought it was something you needed to pass exams on. The idea of learning a thing just because you could pass exams on it is utterly stupid. Anyway, never mind. But Oliver Brown taught my sister French and others, and I've occasionally bumped into folk who found him a teacher. And thought he was a good teacher. And a nice and a lovely man. He taught French. He was very keen on France. He thought that Scotland and France had connections that bypassed England. However, one of Morag's books was a MacLennan publication called The Holiday Book, that came out in 1956, and it had a variety of things in it, but one was a set of letters, essays called How to Succeed. Therefore, you had How to Succeed as a Philosopher. The writer was a man called Jude, whom practically all of you will have forgotten, or maybe not. How to Succeed as a Crime Writer by John Cheney, and but there was How to Succeed as a Pamphleteer by Oliver Brown. I'm going to read it to you, because this has the covers of 10 pamphlets that Oliver Brown wrote between 1930 and 1966. The covers were designed by his wife, Margaret MacDonald, and they're tremendously good covers. They almost explain the entire character of what Sam Bellwise is talking about inside. But I shall read this, How to Succeed as a Pamphleteer or Mein Kampf. and he says, all popular propaganda must contain that touch of virulence which resembles the drop of acid whereby the wise bee seeks to preserve its honey. The pamphlet is essentially a weapon of attack, presenting one aspect of a case with a view to discrediting an opponent, whose past must be examined and all his weaknesses and inconsistencies noted as by a detective agency. For this purpose, the files of newspapers act as ancient rocks containing the marks of prehistoric insects. To find some politician condemning in an opponent some policy which he was later to adopt himself, and to convict him in his own words, gives that feeling of satisfaction felt by the entomologist who pins a strange beetle to an exhibit card. Let the object of your attack be one capable of arousing intense hostility on the one hand and intense loyalty on the other. Between the fell incensed points of mighty opposites, that's a quotation. For man is as much more emotional than rational, because man is much more emotional than rational. Then become absorbed in your subject until it becomes a temporary monomania. No one objects to a bee in the bonnet, provided it produces some honey. Having acquired a deep, though not necessarily wide, knowledge of the subject, the pamphleteer must pepper his matter so as to season it for palates already jaded through incessant propaganda. To startle without injuring truth, and to shock without indecency, should be his aim. Can he coin some original phrase on the model of the expressive Americanism, Chicago Rilla, i.e. the telescoping of two words so to unite two ideas in one. Here are some examples. The relationship of England and the USA, vassalliance. The Make Germany Pay School of Thought, Vansittartism. Vansittart was an English aristocrat who at the end of the Second World War thought that, of course, Germany should be required to pay for all the damage that had happened to Europe when Hitler was running it. The anti-imperialist might sum up the enemy, the seamy side of imperial expansion in the words under the Union jacket. The Scottish reaction to the predominantly Cockney character of the BBC is exactly summed up in the phrase, the Anglo-Saxophone. The muddle about Palestine, the British say the Arabs sold the same horse to both the Jews, and the Arabs, and then kept it to themselves, should be summed up under the title, Palestine, the Too Much Promised Land. this is 1956, by the way. The value of such wisecracking, to use an Americanism for a result of American influence, is twofold. It lightens the style and serves as a mnemonic to the reader. A crisp and forthright style is the first essential, and of almost equal importance is an invariable factual accuracy. One slip may ruin a whole edition and lead to a libel action. Apart from this consideration, a reputation for dependability is essential if a pamphlet is to have any serious influence. To decide what should be included in the pamphlet or rejected depends on the possession of a sense of news values, which may be acquired by a close study of a popular daily like the Express. To counterbalance its influence, the Manchester Guardian should be diligently studied in order to develop a mature judgment and a sense of integrity. If the pamphleteer succeeds in supplying the dexterity of a tightrope walker, his pamphlets will be read with interest by the man in the street and quoted in the council chambers by the expert. And instead of reflecting public opinion, it will have the power of creating it.